At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
On the night of February 13th, 2000, 15-year-old Nick Kunzelman was working the closing shift at a Subway sandwich shop in Littleton, Colorado. At around 10 p.m., his 16-year-old girlfriend, Stephanie Hart Grizel, showed up to hang out as Nick closed down the store. At around 12:45 a.m. on what was now February 14th, another Subway employee drove by and noticed that the store lights were still on. She decided to stop, and when she went inside, she found Nick and Stephanie behind the counter, both dead from gunshot wounds. The young couple's murders shook the community, especially since both teenagers had survived the Columbine High School massacre just 10 months prior. Despite a thorough investigation, no motive or suspects have been identified, leaving two families desperate for answers. It's been more than 24 years since Nick and Stephanie were murdered, and investigators are still searching for the person or people responsible. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. And each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips or leads, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. And like I said in last week's episode, if you can just make sure that your notifications are on if you're watching on YouTube, we've had numerous reports of people who've been unsubscribed or their notifications just randomly turned off and there's really no rhyme or reason to it. It's part of technology, you got to deal with it, a lot of benefits, but there's also a lot of drawbacks. So if you can take a second to just make sure that's all still clicked off, I would greatly appreciate it. Okay, so let's talk about Nick Kunzelman and Stephanie Hart Grizel's case. I want to be upfront with you guys. This is still, in the eyes of the investigators working it, an open investigation, and they are opting not to share a ton of information. Through the research we've done and the interviews that I've seen, it appears that the investigators are still keeping this one close to the vest. You may agree with that, you may not. Most of you know how I feel about that. It's been 24 years. My argument will always be after 24 years, if you haven't solved it, even if you could, you haven't yet. And so now we're getting into that world where even if you solve it at this point, how old is the offender going to be at that point? They've basically lived the majority of their life as a free individual. So what justice is really being served? Yes, the family would have answers, but I can only speak for myself. If I was the parent of one of these children and it took 30 years to find the person who did it, on one hand, I would be grateful that I now have some answers. But on the other hand, after everything settled, I'd say to myself, man, this person basically lived their entire life without any ramifications. And they're going to die in prison, but they're on the back nine at this point. Did they really pay for what they did? So you will see throughout this episode that investigators have spoken with the media, have given updates, have offered rewards, and are definitely proactive in this case. I will say that They're dotting their I's, they're crossing their T's. You're going to get some insight into how many binders they have regarding this case. So they're definitely doing their due diligence. I mean, they've sent this case for analysis all throughout the country. But I still think there's an opportunity here where you can open up a little bit more information and maybe an outside party could help get this case going again. So you may feel differently. I know if you talk to investigators, they will say that because they've kept everything internal, they have been able to rule out some individuals who had came forward and confessed to the murders, and it turned out that they weren't involved, and they were only able to do that by having information that they know to be factual and having these individuals get those facts wrong. So I do see both sides to it, but I feel at this point it's time to maybe take a little bit more risk, not for themselves, but for the family. But I'll let you guys be the judge on that after you hear all the facts. So without wasting any more time, let's get into this week's case. Stephanie Lynn Hart Grizzell was born on October 28, 1983. She grew up in the Columbine, Colorado area with her mother, Kelly, who described her as down to earth and a, quote, flower child. She loved art and music, especially the song On the Turning Away by Pink Floyd. Stephanie was well-liked and had a lot of friends. One friend told KDVR, quote, I've never met anyone like Stephanie. She just had a true glow about her. Everything she did, she drew people in. While in middle school, Stephanie became friends with Nicholas Ray Kunzelman, also known as Nick, who was born on March 15, 1984. Like Stephanie, Nick was really into music and could even play the guitar. He was also skilled in disc golf, and in the late 90s, he was the Colorado State Junior Disc Golf Champion. Nick's brother told the Associated Press, quote, he was a good man. He was the type of brother who was always there, even when he wasn't. In April of 1999, Nick and Stephanie were freshmen at Columbine High School when two gunmen entered the school and shot and killed 12 students and one teacher. 21 additional people were injured by gunshots before the gunmen turned the guns on themselves. And I think almost everybody here knows about the Columbine shooting. If you don't, please research it. It was definitely a tragic set of circumstances that swept our nation. It was before mass shootings in schools became so prevalent, unfortunately. And it was something where there's video from inside the school. So some of what had taken place was caught on camera. It was absolutely horrific. And to think that these children went through this at such a young age and to come out of it to only have this happen, it's absolutely tragic. Now, as far as Stephanie and Nick were concerned, they were uninjured in the massacre, but they and their friends were left reeling after the shooting. Stephanie's mom, Kelly, later told the Denver Post that she told Stephanie that the shooting was the worst life would deal her, but Stephanie responded, quote, Mom, there will be more. And tragically, she was right. Nick and Stephanie became closer after the shooting, and they eventually started dating. They were described as completely in love and inseparable. Nick's stepmother, Teresa, told CBS, quote, It was very strange for two teenagers to be in love like that, but it was so precious. Kelly told Denver 7, quote, Although they had just gone through the tragedy at the high school, they were coming through it so good, and they were so happy. We just felt like that might be the last hard thing that we went through. In January of 2000, Nick, who is now 15 years old, started working at the Subway sandwich shop located in the strip mall at 6768 West Coal Mine Avenue in Littleton, Colorado, just a few blocks from Columbine High School. Within a month of Nick working there, he had gained the trust from the manager to work the closing shift on his own. Now, this in one way was a compliment, but I will tell you that after this whole incident occurred, him working the night shift became a very big deal, and we're going to get into that in a little bit. On February 13th, Nick was scheduled to close the Subway by himself. Some friends came by the store at around 8:30 p.m., and stayed with him until 9:55 p.m., which was 5 minutes before closing. Now, according to his friends, who later spoke to Salon.com, business was slow that night, but there was an unusual late-night customer still inside when they left. At some point after the friends left, Stephanie snuck out of her house and went to pick Nick up. The exact time she arrived is unclear, but we know the store closed at 10 p.m., so it was likely sometime around then. Nick's friend Nathan, who was a former Subway employee, and who had been with Nick that night, later mentioned to Salon that it wasn't uncommon for employees to stay and hang out in the store after closing. He noted that Nick and Stephanie would sometimes spend hours in the shop after it was closed for the night. Now, it's unknown how long Stephanie and Nick wanted to hang out at the shop. What we do know is they had plans to meet up with some friends who had been with Nick at the shop earlier, but they never showed up, which was completely out of character for them. At around 12:45 a.m. on what was now February 14th, also known as Valentine's Day, an employee of Subway where Nick worked drove past the store and noticed that the lights were still on. This was strange because, as I mentioned before, the store was supposed to close by 10 p.m. and it should have been locked up by then. Now, one important thing to note here is that the employee did see a man she didn't recognize leaving out the back of the store. So obviously that made her feel uneasy, so she decided to stop and check things out. At approximately 12:47 a.m., she discovered 15-year-old Nick and 16-year-old Stephanie behind the counter inside the shop, both dead from gunshot wounds. The employee immediately called the police to report what she had found. Unfortunately, very little information has been released about Nick and Stephanie's murders. The police have not revealed where they were shot, how many times they were shot, or what kind of weapon was used. And I know I said earlier that at this point, I think it's important for detectives to release more information about this case. However, this bit of information right here, I do not think should be released. Why is that? I don't think it's going to help solve the case to the people on the outside. What might be helpful is maybe the possible make or model of the gun, but as far as where they were shot and how many times they were shot, that's obviously going to be very difficult for the family to hear. And that is that type of guilt knowledge where if someone comes forward with information and says, "Hey, I know who did this. They said they shot Nick and Stephanie in the head each two times." And it turns out that that is accurate. Well, it's going to give validity to their story. But if they release that information, they lose that ace in the hole. And no one is going to be able to connect anyone to this case if law enforcement says, yeah, they were shot once in the shoulder, once in the leg, and that's all we know at this point. That's not going to have someone go, oh, yeah, I know who it is. But I will say the make of the gun, if they know that information, could potentially be valuable if the gun is a rare model, which if it were, I feel like they would have already released that information to maybe help drum up some new leads. But yet here we are, they haven't. And overall, I am in favor of them releasing certain facts of this case, but these are facts that I'm okay with them holding back. Now, what we do know is that when the police arrived, they were quickly able to determine that this was not a murder-suicide based on what they had in front of them. They also attempted to review surveillance footage from the store, but the cameras were turned off. And we're going to get into why that may have been in a few minutes. Now, we also know the police had interviewed the employee who found Nick and Stephanie, and she told them that she saw a man running away from the area of the store shortly before discovering the bodies. Now, according to the Chicago Tribune, the employee described the man as white, 16 to 18 years old, with blonde hair, approximately 5 feet 8 inches tall, and weighing anywhere from 150 to 170 pounds. Now, I've talked to you guys before about witnesses and their ability to describe potential suspects and how you can take 5 people who see the same thing and they all come back with different descriptions, so you can't put your whole case on it. But for the sake of this conversation here, if we're to believe that this employee is accurate, it is an interesting bit of information because, as I mentioned earlier, the Subway shop was known to have younger individuals hang out there. So when we're thinking about potential scenarios that could have went down here, could it have been that customer was that was last in the store? Maybe. Or could it have been someone who was invited to be there, maybe a friend who was at the store with them, and then something went wrong, the shooting ensued, and then this individual fled the area? This would line up if this witness saw someone who was around the same age as Stephanie and Nick. It would align with the idea that maybe when Stephanie and Nick closed down the store, they were not alone and the person with them was supposed to be there at that time. But we're really just scratching the surface here. We definitely have to dive deeper into the why. Why were these kids hanging out at this specific store? And as we continue through this case, we're definitely going to talk about that. But before we do, let's take our first break.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
Okay, so we're back. And as I mentioned, based on the witness description, we could be looking at someone who was known to Stephanie and Nick. It may have been a friend, or on the other hand, it could have been someone who had a problem with Stephanie or Nick, or maybe the two of them, maybe the fact that they were together. It also could be a coincidence that maybe this was a robbery gone wrong, and it just so happens that the person who committed the crime happened to be similar in age. That's also a possibility. So at this point, everything's still on the table. Now, as this investigation continued into the next morning, Stephanie and Nick's families learned of the tragic news and were beyond distraught. The community, still reeling from the Columbine High School massacre just 10 months prior, was also fractured again by this tragedy. The school district spokesman told the media, quote, "People are extremely upset. There's a sense of, not again, not another senseless tragedy." The Jefferson County District Attorney added, quote, "It's like it's never going to end sometimes. It's one event after another in this community." The following day, the district attorney provided an update on the case, stating that investigators were exploring every possible motive, including robbery. However, they did not have any suspects in custody at that time. Now, on that same day, Salon.com published an article featuring interviews with several townspeople. A local reverend who worked near the subway mentioned that there was a strong suspicion around town that drugs were involved in the murders, and that some students had told him that the store was a known spot to meet up with meth dealers. Salon also spoke to Nick's friend Nathan, who had previously worked at Subway and was there on the night of February 13th hanging out with Nick. Nathan recounted that during his police interview, investigators repeatedly asked him about drugs. But he told Salon that he didn't believe drugs were involved. He said, quote, "I don't think there's really a lot of drugs at that store. Once in a while, you see a couple kids smoking pot there, but not every day. I know Nick's not into drugs." Nathan also mentioned that in his interview, investigators focused on whether anyone in his friend group had conflicts. They asked, quote, "Who was in the store? Were they acting normal? Was anybody mad at anybody?" Nathan told police that he didn't know of any, quote, "significant disputes." Now, I do want to talk about this for a second, because I will tell you, it's not always an enemy who commits these acts. Sometimes it's a friend who turns into a foe in a moment's notice. I've had cases, we had a murder actually, where there was a double homicide. And to make this story short, we didn't really have a clue who was involved until we got access to the victim's cell phone. And on the cell phone, we found photos of another individual who appeared to have been there that night and must have gotten intoxicated and fell asleep on the toilet. Well, one of our victims took a photograph of this individual on the toilet. So we bring them in and we interrogate this person, and they're basically saying the whole time they weren't involved, they weren't involved, they weren't involved. These people were friends of theirs. And then all of a sudden, we start to hammer home the photo and that they were, you know, making fun of him, they were laughing at him. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he looks and says, "Well, they're not laughing now, are they?" And that's when we knew that he had committed the double homicide. But this was someone who had been a friend of these two individuals up to that point. So you just never know where it's going to go. And I'm glad to see that the interrogators in this case are focusing on a variety of things. They're looking at potential drugs. They're looking at the idea that this could have been a robbery based on who was there. They're also exploring the theory that maybe someone who was there just hanging out maybe wasn't acting themselves. And even though they were there hanging out, they might not have been in the right state of mind, or maybe they were there under false pretenses. So glad to see they're exploring all scenarios. And if down the road we did learn that the person responsible for this was a friend of Stephanie and Nick's, I would not be surprised at all. Now, Nathan further shared with Salon that he didn't think a robbery was the motive either. He explained that employees deposited most of the cash into the safe hourly, and there would have been a maximum of $200 on hand before closing, and even that amount of cash would typically have been locked away by 10:15 p.m. Nathan added that it was rare for the surveillance cameras in the store to be on. In his experience, they were only on once every 3 months or so. This is a big blow to this case because if those cameras had been turned on, more than likely, I would not be here discussing this case right now. Why those cameras were off, you can come to your own conclusions. We're going to talk about it a little bit more, but if you have young kids hanging out in the store and they have people who do not work there hanging out as well, including girlfriends or friends, and they're smoking weed or whatever they're doing, they obviously don't want that on footage. My question is, what are the owners or the managers doing? Are they allowing this to happen? Are they aware of it? Are they okay with it? Or are they just not doing their jobs and not following up like they should because there's been no previous incidents there, so they had no reason to look at the footage? Either way, it's a lack of responsibility on part of the owners and the managers. At minimum, this was just negligence. They weren't doing their job. They weren't filling their responsibilities. Worst case scenario, they knew what was going on at the store and they were okay with it, and they were allowing them to turn off the cameras. That's an even bigger issue. And there's more to come from this because, as you can imagine, as these stories started to come out, Stephanie's family was not happy about it and they weren't going to just let it slide. So let's put that aside for now, because the investigation did continue and the police learned that another witness had seen a white man running away from the subway around the same time as the employee. Now, sketch artists were brought in and they met with the employee and the other witness and were able to create two sketches that were released to the public. The police received numerous tips based on these sketches, but unfortunately, none of them led to the killer. As part of the investigation, the police also interviewed Nick and Stephanie's friends, who were fellow students at Columbine High School. The fact that the police were interviewing Columbine students led some people to believe that the massacre at Columbine and the double homicides might be connected. I don't know how you would get there just from that. These were students that went to Columbine, so obviously some of their friends would attend Columbine, and obviously the police would want to speak with them. But again, you have the court of public opinion, and when law enforcement leaves these voids, people out there with misinformation are going to fill those holes. And if that's all that the public is hearing, sometimes it can gain legs and it becomes fact, even though there's no truth to it whatsoever. And that's why it's important for police to come out and correct that narrative, which in this case, that's exactly what they did. They stressed that the murders of Nick and Stephanie did not appear to be connected to the Columbine massacre. They were only speaking to students because that's where Nick and Stephanie attended high school. You would think that would be common sense for most, but apparently not. And as far as I can tell, up to this point, the police have never found a connection between the massacre and the murders of Nick and Stephanie. But the reality is, as long as this case goes unsolved, as long as there's still a question of who did this, people are still going to speculate. And in fairness to them, there is a world where they're right. So you have the investigation going on, and on February 19th, a funeral for Nick and Stephanie was held, with more than 2,000 people showing up to pay their respects. Nick and Stephanie were buried together, as their parents knew they wanted to be together forever. Later, a memorial bench was placed at their gravesite, and it reads, quote, "Together in peace forever." As the community was mourning the losses of two more Columbine students, the police continued their investigation into the murders. By February 23rd, they had conducted 200 interviews and received over 150 tips about the case. The police told the Associated Press that based on everything they knew so far, they did not think the double homicide was a random crime of opportunity. They stated, quote, "We don't believe it was somebody who was just walking through the area and committed the crimes." The police went on to say that they weren't sure about a motive, and they refused to comment on reports that money was found in the cash register after the shooting. So in these situations, I always like to try to read between the lines of what the cops are saying without saying it. And I think it's pretty self-explanatory. They don't believe that just some random person who happened to see the lights on at Subway decided, hey, this is a good place to rob. There should be a lot of money in here. They believe that whoever killed Stephanie and Nick more than likely knew them, whether they were friends of theirs or it was someone who had a problem with them. But they knew of this place and they knew that it had been kept open after hours for other people to come and hang out. Whether there were drugs involved, you can speculate on that. But this person knew about this place, and for some reason they went there to hang out, or because they had an axe to grind, and they knew more than likely at this point Nick would probably be there alone or with a friend or two. Maybe this individual didn't even know that Stephanie would be there. She just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. But what I'm taking from this is that law enforcement believes whoever's involved in their murders is someone who is somehow connected to Nick, whether it's through a friend or directly to Nick and Stephanie. This person is someone who's familiar to the community. There's still a lot more to talk about this case. We have the federal government getting involved. We also have a civil lawsuit coming. We're going to cover the rest of this case right after this last break. Okay, so before the break, we were talking about the statements made by police and what it might have meant. And after these statements were made, the investigation continued, but there were a few major updates in the case until July, when it was revealed that the Subway store was issued an $18,625 fine for having Nick close the store. This is something that I had mentioned earlier to you guys. And the whole story behind it was Nick was under 16 years old. So he was only legally allowed to work until 7 p.m. on school nights and 9 p.m. on non-school nights. So having Nick close the store and work until 10 p.m. violated federal child labor laws. The district director for the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division determined that if Subway had followed labor laws, Nick would not have been working the closing shift and therefore would not have been killed. In February of 2001, a year had passed since Stephanie and Nick were murdered. That month, Stephanie's mom, Kelly, filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the owner of the Subway where the murders took place. She claimed that the Subway had been the home of a drug ring and that this drug ring led to her daughter's murder. The Associated Press reported that in the lawsuit, Kelly argued that the back of the store was used for drug deals. She claimed that Nick could have unknowingly let the killer in through the back door after closing the store, thinking they were there to buy drugs. The lawsuit also alleged that the store intentionally turned off their surveillance cameras to avoid catching these drug deals on camera. And I have to tell you, on paper, this does seem like a valid theory. We talked about the cameras earlier. Were they functional? It appears that they were. If they weren't, I think it would have came out like that. So if the cameras were operational, why weren't they on? And if it were the kids turning them off at night, why didn't the manager or the owners do something about it, saying, hey, why are you guys turning the cameras off at night? And if that wasn't the case, were the managers and owners just not checking their equipment at all for months at a time to see if it was operational? Like I said, it's just pure negligence, or is there something more nefarious here? Which brings up Kelly's theory. If by chance the manager and or the owners were aware that some type of drug activity was happening at the establishment after hours, were they getting some type of kickback? Were they indirectly involved in some other way? And were they intentionally turning off the cameras and keeping them off so that if law enforcement did come around, there would be nothing documented in footage to implicate them or the people they were involved with? Now, as I just mentioned, I have nothing to prove that this was in fact the case, but based on rumors that were going around that community, clearly Kelly did think there was some validity to this theory, and that's why she decided to take legal action. Now, unfortunately, it didn't work out for her because the lawsuit was eventually dismissed by a district court judge, but the rumor that drugs were involved in the murders continued. In February of 2002, the police told the Associated Press that they had followed leads as far as Florida and had conducted 20 polygraphs, but still didn't have any suspects. They mentioned that tips were still coming in periodically, and some witnesses had been re-interviewed based on new information. They emphasized that they had, quote, not lost hope in solving the case. In a shocking turn of events, the police revealed for the first time that there was no evidence of a robbery, and they were exploring the possible connection to drugs. And as part of the murder investigation, they had conducted interviews in over 50 drug cases to determine if a drug ring had been operating out of the Subway. Now, even with everything they did, no new evidence in the murders came to light. However, there was a silver lining here because despite the inability to find a connection to the murders, there was enough evidence compiled to prosecute 35 individuals for selling cocaine and meth to young people in their teens and early 20s. Now, it's important to note that these charges were entirely unrelated to the murders themselves, but this is still a big win here because I can tell you, as a former narcotics detective, where you have drugs, you have robberies, you have sexual assaults, you have murders. So getting people that are distributing narcotics in your community off the streets and behind bars is a win for everyone. Now, unfortunately, as it relates to Stephanie and Nick, this was one of the last major updates in the case. And over the years, Stephanie's mom and Nick's stepmom continued to speak with the media, making sure the public knew that the case remained unsolved and that they were still seeking answers. In 2017, the police provided an update stating that they had accumulated 40 binders of information, which included details from hundreds of interviews. They also had over 150 items of evidence. Over the years, DNA, fingerprints, and other evidence collected from the scene had been tested by labs all over the country, but nothing had come from the testing. Now, as far as the 40 binders of information, you may think to yourself, oh, they have to be embellishing. That seems like an awful lot. But that can happen in these cases. We had investigations in our evidence locker where there was 20, 30, 40 binders based on different reports that have come in, different investigators who had done their own reports on the case after reviewing the case file. So the file cabinet for each individual investigation can build up very quickly. And I will say there were videos online that I watched from different media outlets where they were allowed access into these closed locations, I'm assuming under supervision of investigators, and you could actually see the binders in the background. So it does appear to be valid, and it does show that although we're not there yet, and although I may not agree with every approach that these investigators have taken, they are doing their due diligence, and it appears that there's no ego involved. They're reaching out to outside sources and using every type of DNA or fingerprint or blood analysis, whatever they have. They're using all sciences and resources available. So even though we are where we are right now, it's not because investigators aren't trying to solve this case. And speaking of keeping things close to the vest, the police further revealed that holding information back in the case had proven useful, as a few people had falsely confessed to the murders over the years. The police were able to determine that their confessions were false based on the details they withheld. So I've already said this, there is truth to this, they're not lying. Having that guilt knowledge, specifics about the case that you do not let anyone outside your organization know, will allow you to test the credibility and validity of witnesses and or suspects. So you do want to keep certain details in-house so that when you have someone come in, you have a way of figuring out whether they're telling the truth or not. But I stand by the fact that it's been 24 years. It doesn't appear that they're on the verge of solving this case. And if there are other details that can be revealed without giving away everything, I still think we should do it. I still think we're at a point in this case where it's a cold case, but this is a real cold case. Cases after 5, 6, 7, 10 years, they're also labeled cold cases. But the reality is, relatively speaking to cold cases, they're still new. 24 years old, it's not new. And now the offender at minimum is probably in their 30s or 40s, and they're not getting any younger. So we have to find this person as soon as possible, not only to make sure that they don't hurt anybody else, because they could be hurting people all these years, but also to make sure that they serve the majority of their life behind bars where they deserve to be. Now, by 2020, 2 decades had passed since Stephanie and Nick were murdered, and the cold case detective assigned to the case sat down with CBS and discussed where the case was currently at. When asked if drugs were possibly involved in the murders, the detective said, quote, "I can't say whether the homicides were related to drug use or anything like that." The detective mentioned that he wasn't sure how many people were involved in the murders, but he believed there were people in the community who knew. He added that many of the tips they received over the past 20 years were based on theories or rumors people had heard. The detective stated, quote, "We don't want to discourage anybody from coming forward with information they feel like sharing. The information we are really looking for is people who have knowledge or firsthand knowledge specifically of what took place, what led up to the murders, during the murders, or after the murders. What they heard or know, 20 years is a long time. A lot of people's lives have changed. People's circumstances change. We are hoping that they are willing to share what they kept secret for 20 years. And that's a really impactful statement because it's true. There may have been people at the time who knew what happened but decided to stay quiet because of whatever circumstance they were currently in. But as the detective said, people's circumstances change. And over time, as this individual experiences life for themselves, maybe goes on to have children of their own, their perspective on different things may evolve. And because of how they currently feel, all it might take is hearing from this detective or, who knows, listening or watching a podcast to say, you know what? I can't stay quiet any longer. I can't keep the secret to myself, and I'm going to do something about it. And that information that they have, if it's good information, is as relevant today as it was when it occurred. So that's why we keep talking about it. That's why these detectives are saying what they're saying, and that's why I'm covering these cases. There are people with the keys to open the door that solves this case. We just got to get them to come in. We just got to get them to come forward. We got to get their foot over the threshold to let them know that it's never too late to make a difference for not only the victims, but the victims' families. Now, in May of 2021, Metro Denver Crime Stoppers announced a temporary $100,000 award for information leading to the arrest of those involved in the murders. The Jefferson County Sheriff's Office stated that they believe someone has information on the murders and they hope the reward would entice them to come forward. Unfortunately, the high reward did not lead to a break in the case, and the police reported that the reward for information was now $60,000, and they emphasized that they were still seeking information to break the case open. And that's really the last update we have in this case. Stephanie and Nick's murders remain unsolved, and although their families get together every year at Nick and Stephanie's gravesite to celebrate their lives, they still have not given up hope that one day their killer will be brought to justice. All right, let's get into my perspective and continue discussing what I've been talking about this entire episode. We have a couple theories here. We have the theory that there was someone, a customer, who may be in the store at the time of closing, where the friends leave, that person is still there. Once the friends leave, this individual, for whatever reason, decides to rob Nick. Maybe Stephanie isn't even there yet. Maybe she walks in on what's transpiring. But during that time, everything goes down around the same time frame in which the person's robbing Nick. Stephanie shows up, or she might have just arrived. And for some reason, this individual decides to escalate the situation from a robbery of a couple hundred bucks to the murder of two young teenagers. It seems like a big escalation. It doesn't make a lot of sense for all that risk, for that little of a reward. And to me, it doesn't seem likely. We have to consider it, but it wouldn't be at the top of my list. What's more likely to me is one of two scenarios. You have a situation here where we may not know who this person is, but although Nick and Stephanie were great people and everyone appeared to love the fact that they were together, there might have been someone out there who didn't feel that way, who didn't like Nick or didn't like Stephanie or didn't like the two of them together. Maybe there was a jealousy factor to it. Maybe there was something about that couple where this individual felt like they just couldn't allow it to happen any further. So knowing that Nick and Stephanie had hung out at the Subway numerous times before after hours, this individual was someone who was acquainted with that circle of friends and knew about these specifics and waited for Nick and Stephanie to be alone before arriving at this location and then killing them both intentionally. I don't know why another teenager, if we're to believe the witnesses that this individual seen running from the location was the killer, this young individual, would be so angry, would be so upset that they'd be willing to kill two innocent people like this for really no reason at all. But you have to think about where we are in society, and you also have to think about this particular area, what had just happened 10 months prior. Two monsters walked into a high school and for no reason at all, killed multiple people. So you can't always rationalize the irrational. There are things that happen out there every day, and we see them in the news, where most of us can't understand why someone would do the things that we get to see with our own eyes and ears, hurting animals, hurting other people. It just doesn't compute to us because for most people, it's not even a possibility. But there are individuals out there who are just bad people, and they will do things just because it's what they want to do. They don't think like you and I. And so is there a world that there was someone in this group of friends who was able to remain under the radar, but inside was burning with rage and was waiting to unleash that rage on some unsuspecting people? And in this case, that would have been Nick and Stephanie. That is the second scenario. And yes, it's more likely than the first one. But I think this third scenario is the most likely. And that's that there were some type of drug dealings going on at this location. Was Nick involved? Was he not involved? It really doesn't matter. He was there and he was somehow involved, whether that was just letting people in or just being present for what was transpiring. Somehow he was connected to this. There is a world, even though it doesn't change how I feel about Nick or Stephanie, where Nick might have been directly involved in some type of drug activity. It really doesn't matter to me for the sake of this case. He shouldn't have had his life ended the way he did, but we just have to be realist here. We have to talk about all the scenarios. So some way or another, there was something going on at this location, and I think it's reasonable to assume that if it was going on at this location, there's no way that Nick wouldn't be aware of what was going on. What his role was, we may never know. But if he's there, he knows what's transpiring. And if that is the case, as I mentioned earlier, when you're dealing with drugs, you're not only susceptible to the things that go on with drug activity, you're also opening yourself up to a plethora of different crimes: larceny, robbery, sexual assault, and even murder. And if Nick saw something or was involved in something where this individual felt like they were going to go to the police, or maybe they saw Nick as a competitor and they decided to take out their competition, there is a world where Nick was the target of the shooting and it just so happened that Stephanie was in the wrong place at the wrong time. That to me seems more likely, because if that's the case and we're dealing with some really dangerous people who have a lot to lose if police figure out what they're doing at this location, they may feel that the only way to tie up this loose end is to take out Nick and anybody who's with him. And so I feel that's where we are on this one. And to me, to solve this case, other individuals who were at that location on different occasions and also had similar interactions with Nick or his counterparts or people that were actually distributing narcotics out of that location, they know what went down. They know the dynamics of the drug dealings that were taking place there. They know who was on one side of the road, who was on the other, who was working together, and who was working against each other. Why haven't they come forward? More than likely because they were involved in something that they shouldn't have been involved in. They may have been selling drugs themselves. They may have been using drugs. And I'm sure there's a fear of retaliation if the people responsible for Nick and Stephanie's death are still out there. And maybe it's one person who carried out this murder, but how connected are they? This may run a lot deeper than we currently know. So even if the witness comes forward who knows who did it and says something, and this suspect or suspects get taken off the street, there may be other individuals still out there who could come back, and there could be some type of aftermath because of it, where now the witness and their family are in danger because of what they shared. So where does this leave us? Well, it's a place we're very familiar with at this point. We need someone to come forward. So if you or somebody you know has information that can solve this case, I implore you, I beg you to come forward. And if you're unsure if what you know, if what you've seen, if what you heard could be relevant to the case, don't make that decision. Let law enforcement decide. So just to recap, at some point between 10 p.m. on February 13th, 2000 and 12:45 a.m. on February 14th, Nick Kunzelman and Stephanie Hart Grizel were shot inside the subway located at 6768 West Coal Mine Avenue in Littleton, Colorado. A white man between the ages of 16 and 18 years old with blonde hair, around 5 feet 8 inches tall and weighing between 150 and 170 pounds, was seen leaving the subway just before Stephanie and Nick's bodies were found. If you have any information about the murders of Stephanie and Nick, please contact the Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. There is a reward available. And as always, my final thoughts go out to the family. As I mentioned earlier in this episode, every year, Nick and Stephanie's families get together where the bench, the memorial bench was placed at their gravesite. They hang out, they play games together, and they just reminisce about the past. And I'm sure that does do something for them to try and move on with their lives as they continue to deal with this nightmare every single day. But the reality of the situation is they need answers. And the only way we're going to get there is someone who's listening to this or someone who's watching this finally has the courage to come forward and do the right thing. And until that day comes, we're going to stick right here. And if there's any updates, I'll be sure to let you guys know. But until then, stay safe out there, and I'll see you next week.